So I hope we get a chance at the end for some questions and discussion, because I think that story might not be quite as bleak as Ben made it out to be, and I think there's certainly counter currents at WHO, although it faces enormous institutional challenges. And I should confess that I work closely on a number of rights-based initiatives centered at WHO, including a steering committee on the evidence of impact of rights-based approaches and human rights and equity-based approach to the path to universal health coverage. And the WHO has been more active than ever in pushing guidance at the Human Rights Council. So I think it has some more nuances than maybe Ben said. But I want to focus on a slightly different story. I want to look at what happens at national level, where all human rights are, including the right to health, are ultimately realized, and talk about the phenomenon of courts, national courts, enforcing health rights, and to see whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And I think if you take away anything from this talk, I hope it is that this is something that the public health community should be paying more attention to. Because across the world, across middle-income countries, courts, judiciaries, are making decisions that are affecting health budgets, health policies, health planning, in a way that the public health community needs to be tuned into. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to go through a little bit the origins and magnitude of health rights litigation around the world and its importance, some of the reasons for the impetus of health rights litigation in certain countries, because it hasn't emerged everywhere, and what are the equity implications, and sometimes it's difficult to tell what the equity implications are. This is based largely on a book that Siri Gluppen of the Christian Michelsen Institute and the University of Bergen and I co-edited that came out a couple of years ago, in which we looked very in-depth at what was happening in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, India, and South Africa, as well as subsequent research. I was appointed as an independent expert to the Colombian Constitutional Court thereafter and have done subsequent research to date. I should say it's also based on the definition of cases will determine what your conclusions are with respect to health rights litigation. We looked at places where there was a constitutional right to health or a related right, and which closely mirrored the definition of the right to health set out in General Comment 14. In terms of the elements. And I should say that the broad, complete state of physical, social, mental, and social well-being set out in the WHO preamble is not something that is eagerly susceptible to judicial enforcement. The carving out of contours of what would be a legal entitlement in terms of complete social, mental, and physical well-being is not something that at domestic level has really been taken on, and it's not used. So what are the origins? Health rights litigation sprang up across the world with HIV/AIDS. In many ways, HIV/AIDS affected the health and human rights movement. You see courts responding to cases of people who want entitlements to medications, ARVs, very much the way in Costa Rica this case from 1997 happens. What good are the rest of rights and guarantees, the advantages and benefits of our system of liberties, if a person cannot count on the right to life and health insured? So this intimate connection between the right to health and the right to life was central to the enforceability of the right to health in certain cases. In the countries where there is an enormous amount of health rights litigation, we see closed political channels. So South Africa is the obvious one with Mbeki's AIDS denialism, where you would expect a movement to get new drugs like ARVs listed in an insurance system to move through political channels. But for one reason or another, either because of AIDS denialism or because of chronic democratic failure, those channels were blocked. At the same time as those channels were blocked, you see very favorable legal opportunity structures, which led people to go to courts. And what do I mean by that? In South America, in the 1980s and early 1990s, you see new constitutions with robust enumerations of economic and social rights, including the right to health. You also see structural changes, the establishment of a high court as a specialized tribunal overseeing a new constitutional jurisdiction. This is in the South African Constitution, the Colombian Constitution of 1991, for example. The application of constitutional review to specific cases through protection writs is across many of the South American cases, tutela in Colombia, amparo jurídico in Argentina, for example, a similar mechanism in Brazil, which has a very short response time. So if you file a tutela, the court has 10 days to respond. If you file an amparo in Brazil or Argentina as a interim measure, you have 72 hours for the court to respond and provide you with an answer, and usually it's yes, you have a right to this medication, you have a right to this surgery, etc. So it's not the kind of long litigation that we are used to thinking about in the United States. Reduction of standing requirements, very, very few standing requirements, if any, in many of these countries in South America, and a reduction, a certain reduction in South Africa, India, for example. A definite move away from legal formalism, and the idea that these constitutional courts should iconically serve to implement emancipatory visions of a new social democratic order was very, very important. And speed of resolution, as I've already mentioned. And all of these factors, or almost all of these factors, are present in every country where we see a rise in health rights litigation. So going back to HIV/AIDS litigation as the origins, I think it's useful to look at the origins, not because it gives a recipe for what should be done in future cases, but because it has some lessons for the future. One, they were attached to strong social movements. It wasn't just litigation of one person. It was PLWAs mobilizing in South Africa, Brazil, India, around the world creating networks. Two, there was a challenge to the power of the market. There was this idea that if it was a right to health, that it wasn't up to pharmaceutical companies to decide what the market price was, but that governments had an obligation to level the playing field in terms of access to these life-saving medications. That is not the case in many cases that are actually fostered by pharmaceutical companies today in a number of jurisdictions for very costly medications. There was a clearly defined duty bearer, so the Ministry of Health or the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, and a clearly defined remedy, this medication. Very different from, say, pollution cases, other kinds of preventative public health cases, very, very different. Easy for the court to say, to give a black letter order saying, yes, give this medication to this person. And again, this clear link to the right to life, as often with discrimination and treatment of marginalized or vulnerable groups, but this clear link to the right to life, which when the right to health was so intimately linked to the right to life, it became transmuted into not a directive principle under these constitutions, but an enforceable legal entitlement. And that has implications, because it may not be that priority setting in health systems always wants to prioritize the medication that may save somebody's life, that in a terminal cancer case, for example, it may very clearly be an issue of a right to life. But there are other issues that we consider in priority setting in healthcare, from cost effectiveness to clinical effectiveness, capacity to benefit, all of these other implications. There has grown a tension between judicial enforcement of health rights and what health ministries would ordinarily like to do if they were rational, utilitarian decision makers. So I also want to say that there is a difference among contexts. This phenomenon of health rights litigation is not the same across countries. Opportunity structures differ tremendously. In Latin America, you see thousands, tens of thousands. In Colombia, since 1999, over 1 million cases of health rights litigation, which are for individual claims to entitlements, individuals exploiting the system to get benefits that they need. Whereas in other contexts, Like South Africa and India, you see structural cases, largely PIL cases, public interest litigation in India, largely cases brought by the same groups in South Africa. Treatment Action Campaign has brought over half of the cases, which are for structural reform of the system in one way or another. Those differences have very, very different equity implications. Even within South America, there is a big difference between countries where you see the health system react quickly to litigation and routinely incorporate a medication that is often litigated into the general health insurance scheme and universalize that care, versus a country where you see repeated litigation for the same medication over and over and over again, and you can imagine the transaction costs that that happens. So in Brazil, or in Costa Rica, there's much more routine universalization, whereas in Argentina and Colombia, there has previously not been. Structural decisions are not always implemented, and there are a lot of confounding factors along the way. Probably the largest and most important decision in this case came after all of this wave of individual cases in Colombia. T-760-08 came down from the Constitutional Court in 2008, restructuring the health system. Since 2008, there have been a series of health reforms. There is now major, major political health reform going on in Colombia. And so there are a lot of ways in which you can't necessarily attribute it to the decision in Colombia, but it triggered a cascade of different changes, I would say. So some of the challenges in determining economic equity and other impacts: time, how long, how soon. In many of the South African cases, it looked like they weren't being implemented or complied with. At the 5-year mark, at the 10-year mark, things looked very, very different. The scope of what is the impact on direct litigants or indirect litigants in society, or even when jurisprudence is taken up in another country and affects people in another country. Attribution, as I said, would it, could it have happened without the litigation? Direct impacts on the litigants versus indirect, policy impacts, laws, budgeting, health policies that are affected, designation of beneficiaries, for example. And then there's this question of material versus symbolic dimensions of impact. So in this case I mentioned in Colombia, T-760-08, it certainly is the case that it had symbolic dimensions of impact. And César Rodríguez Garavito of the University of the Andes has written about this. It opened the health sector, just as in the United States, was filled with people with powerful corporate interests, and it opened a public arena to issues that had been blocked and marginalized for a very long time. It also transformed public perception of health as a commodity to be allocated by these HMOs that exist in Colombia to a rights issue. And not just among, you know, us lefty progressive lawyers, but among Catholic priests and lay people who were marching out on the street. The discourse in the media changed notably. It promoted discussion in the Congress about what we owe each other, what we mean by a health system that functions and serves everyone, what inequalities are we willing to tolerate and not. So some kind of deliberative democracy in a context that is egregiously unequal still to this day. So conclusions. I think that there are possibilities for an important judicial role in requiring justification of policies. Health policymaking is one of the most opaque areas of policymaking there is, and most decisions are made beyond closed doors, that people who are affected, their interests are affected, are never consulted. There is a possibility that judiciaries can establish more of a culture of justification. Context matters. People who tell you that that courts getting involved in this lead to more inequity or to more equity in the realization of the right to health are full of it. Context matters. You have to be nuanced when you judge these situations. And when you judge them, the situation evolves over time. In some situations, there may be a reallocation of resources toward curative care. We've seen that, especially when there's active involvement of pharmaceutical companies pushing this litigation. versus broader public health interventions that would serve more of the poor. We need more empirical studies on impact, and we need better methodologies to study impact, really, and what impact matters, not just material impact, but also this symbolic ideational impact I mentioned. And then we need to situate it in the larger context. What are courts actually doing, and how does it relate to the overall equity in society, the overall system of justice, overall social determinants, and social movements and mobilization? Thank you.